Welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today's program is on how the courts work with victims of domestic violence. This program completes a series of shows over the last few months looking at the protective role that courts play. Previously, we've looked at the legal concerns of the elderly, the mentally impaired, and children. I'm joined in the studio today by my legal expert and co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Judge Andrews, welcome to you, and please introduce our guests to the listeners.
Well, thanks, Kathleen. We're happy to be here today, and in the studio we have two folks who know a great deal about this topic. First, we have Marjorie Thayer. She's been working with victims of domestic violence for over 18 years. Over the years at AWAKE, she's held many positions and is currently one of the three AWAKE, that's the Anchorage Women Aid in Crisis is the acronym.
Alaska Women's...
It's Abused Women's Aid in Crisis.
Okay, Abused Women's Aid in Crisis.
Thank you, Marjorie.
Yes, she's a legal advocate employed by that agency, and she has an office at the Boney Courthouse in Anchorage working with Domestic Violence Division. She's been in her current position as a court-based legal advocate since November of 2002. She is a lifelong Alaskan. We also have Judge Patrick Hanley. He was raised in Alaska, graduate of Diamond High School, went out of state for college, but returned to Alaska after he completed law school. And he was also a teacher in rural Alaska. I might ask him a few questions about that when we get started. He also has worked as a commercial fisherman. He has clerked for the Court of Appeals, worked as a prosecutor for the Municipality of Anchorage and State of Alaska, and he was appointed to the District Court in 2005. And he now is there as a District Court judge.
Well, welcome, everybody. We're so glad to have you on. I just want to remind our listeners we've got some resources on the website under Hometown Alaska at alaskapublic.org. You'll hear references to protective orders and self-help forms and things like that that the court system provides. We have those links on alaskapublic.org. And I'd also like to let our listeners know we welcome you to join in this conversation with questions or experiences that are relevant to today's topic. We're happy to hear from you. You can give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752. In statewide, and we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Judge Andrews, let's get started.
Well, domestic violence is a huge topic, and we are not going to be able to do it justice today, but we're going to try and focus mostly on the topic of domestic violence as it relates to the Alaska court system and how the court deals with that topic in processing and working with in processing requests for assistance and how it relates to the work that the court does. So we have a domestic violence division in the courthouse. We have a very, I would say, intensive and broad-based program. And I do want to give credit to the two magistrate judges who really were very instrumental and innovative in providing the structure that we have now, Magistrate Suzanne Cole and Magistrate Judge Jennifer Wells, both of whom really did, I would say, pioneering work to create the structure we have now. So let me ask Marjorie, if a person believes that they're a victim of domestic violence and they want to go to the court to get help, where do they go and when do you see them?
Sure. They go to the Boney Courthouse, which is 303 K Street, and it's on K Street in between 3rd and 4th Avenues, so downtown. The domestic violence office is located on the first floor, and that domestic violence office is open 7 days a week and on holidays. The court system domestic violence office is open from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. Monday through Friday, and open from 12 noon until 8 p.m. Saturday, Sunday, and holidays also.
So that's an amazing amount of time. I mean, the court system isn't open for other business during those hours. So this is something special that the court does for this type of proceeding.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Domestic Violence Office is the only office in the courthouse that has those extended hours, and it's needed. Domestic violence doesn't happen, you know, cuts off at 4:30.
Okay. And is there an awake advocate there? I mean, obviously you can't work all those hours. Do you have someone else who works there as well?
I am very fortunate to have two other coworkers. So an awake advocate is stationed at the courthouse all of the hours that the courthouse is open. So we have staff there Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. until 8 p.m., and on weekends, 12 noon until 8 p.m.
Okay. So if I come down and I want to fill out a form and I'm unsure, and maybe I don't speak English, maybe I'm nervous. Are you going to help me with that? Is that what would happen if I didn't speak English and I needed help? And I'm assuming you are an English speaker, but maybe don't have other language skills. What happens then?
You're right. I only speak English. However, there is a language line that we can tap into, and if somebody were to come into our office and doesn't speak English, we have got a sign that for language access that they can point to, and it says I speak, and it lists all sorts of different languages, and it says it in that language. So that way I would know what language they speak. I can then dial up the language line and get an interpreter on the phone, and I would be able to have a conversation through an interpreter with the individual that came to see me to find out what are their needs. Do they need shelter? Do they need a protective order? Do they need to talk to somebody about domestic violence and what's going on in their home?
Okay. And Judge Hanley, are those services unique to domestic violence cases, or does the court system offer that language line in other cases?
The language line has been expanded, and so they're used in all kinds of different cases now. The idea that access to justice should be widely available. So they are available for domestic violence protective orders, but for other hearings too.
Okay. And let me ask you, Judge Hanley, if someone comes down and they file a petition and they come in front of you, what kinds of things would entitle a person to, and we're going to call these a short-term order just because these, you know, over the years we've used different words to describe these various orders, but a short-term order, as I understand it, is something of an emergency order, and it lasts for 20 days until there's another hearing. But in order for you to grant an order, what would the petitioner have to show you to give you the authority to grant an order?
Well, there's two types of protective orders. One of them is the domestic violence protective order that we see most frequently. The other one is kind of a related order, which is a stalking order. But most of the ones we see are domestic violence protective orders. And for the court to issue one of those, there have to be several requirements that are satisfied. First, it has to be domestic. So it has to be involving a household member, and there's definitions of that. It includes spouses and former spouses, people in a dating relationship, past or present, if people have a child together, if people have lived together or live together now, like roommates, or if they're related by blood or adoption to a certain degree of kinship. Then that's the first requirement. So if they don't meet that requirement, then you cannot issue a domestic violence protective order. And then the second part is there must be probable cause to believe that a specific crime was committed, and specific in the domestic violence protective order statutes. So typically you would see things like assault, which could include physical assault or a fear assault, but also reckless endangerment, kidnapping, robbery, terroristic threatening. There's harassment, and actually one that's been added is cruelty to animals. If the animal is a pet of that person, of the petitioner, we would call it, and that was just passed this legislative session.
Okay, so these are legal proceedings, and so to some extent we need to use a little bit of the jargon. So when we talk about a petitioner, that's the person who is seeking the order, and the person who they're seeking it against, we call the respondent.
Correct.
Okay.
Judge Anderson, we have a caller, and so I don't know if they have a specific question about the petition or the protective order, but I'd like to welcome Len onto Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Len.
Hi.
What's your question?
Yeah, it's just to relate an experience that ties in with your topic. My daughter, Jessica, was killed by her domestic partner in Kentucky back in 2005. She was, we've come to learn, we got involved with domestic violence advocacy for the victims and all of that. But she was basically in rural Kentucky. She had been convinced by her boyfriend not to file a protective order and prevented from filing it. The court was far away, or where she had to go to file any kind of complaint against him was far away. Her car was disabled, and she was walking. She finally decided to leave him and walk to town from her rural community. And on her way into town, he drove up on her and apparently ran her over. Her children, we're uncertain where her children with. We understand that they were brought along as enticement for her to get into the car. But anyway, she was run over by him, that much we know. And something happened. We don't know what happened with the kids, but she ended up dropped off at the hospital with injuries from being run over, and then he left the hospital. He may have gone to the hospital with one vehicle and then came back later with his dad with a different vehicle with my daughter. With a different vehicle to check up on my daughter, who had passed away in the interim. But anyway, all of this strikes close to home. And all I could say is, yes, if you are being abused, you got to do whatever you have to do to follow through with it. My daughter didn't. She thought she could change her abuser. She thought she could beat him or, beat him in a fist fight or whatever. Mm-hmm. In the end, a vehicle was bigger than her fist. So she lost. She lost her life. We had to eventually, he was a loser, didn't have a job. So we had to eventually file for custody, and we did get custody of those kids for neglect in Kentucky, and got custody of them in Ohio and brought them to Alaska to be far away from him because the police did not pursue the investigation and could not, because of the way that the whole thing unfolded, could not get a grand jury to indict him.
Lynn, I just want to express my sorrow for what happened to you and tell you that I really appreciate you sharing a real story when we are talking about, how the courts try to deal with this, and learning your story is just very sad. And I really appreciate that you called up and shared it, and it has a lot of meaning. So thank you.
This is an area that, as we say, it's incredibly broad. And we are looking at obtaining domestic violence protective orders, but people will always tell you the protective order is just a piece of paper. It's one means to stay protected, and certainly it's important. But let me ask Marjorie, in terms of a safety plan for women who might find themselves in the position that Len's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of things does AWAKE recommend in terms of safety plans for women who might find themselves wanting to get away and they're unsure how to do it?
That's a really good question. And I just wanted to say I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
As far as a safety plan, the important thing to remember is it's not a one-size-fits-all. We definitely meet with people if they can come to our office at the Awake Shelter. We'll talk about lots of different things, what kind of family support they have, what kind of financial resources are there. Are there pets in the family? How old are the kids? All sorts of different things when we look at trying to safety plan. Definitely the things that you described that happened with your daughter, super common. Moving somebody out into a rural area, making them believe it's their fault. But when the victim does decide that that may be time to leave, we'll talk about all these other things. Like, are they able to stash a couple of dollars away? Maybe every paycheck or every month, perhaps packing a bag that has the kids' clothes in it, at least a pair or two of socks and pants and shirt, a favorite toy, kids' medicine, some of her clothes. And can she stash it someplace? Can she hide it maybe in the trunk of the car or on the floor of the closet? So that way, if there is an assault going on and she does decide to leave, she doesn't have to run around the house trying to find all these things and throw them in a bag. She can just grab her prepacked bag and go. We'll also talk about, is it possible to vary your route for how you get to and from places? Are there people that you can go to for help that you trust? Are there neighbors that you can maybe talk to? I think with domestic violence, part of the thing with domestic violence is that there is such shame attached to it, and that the people that are being abused generally don't want to talk about it. There is a lot of shame. You're meant to feel bad. You're meant to feel like it's your fault. But I think that the more people that know what's going on with you, the more people can look out for you. So while it is extremely hard to talk about domestic violence, and that's part of what keeps it a dirty secret, that people don't want to talk about it, but the more that you can, and the more that you can let people know that's going on, the more that they can look out for you. So we talk about all those sorts of things. We talk about getting a protective order or not. Sometimes that's not the right course of action, and only the person in that relationship is going to know what's best for them.
Mm-hmm. A lot of options. Really, really thank you, Lynn, so much for letting us... By bringing that topic up, it allowed us to talk about some of the critical things that have to happen in a case.
Right. And so let me go back to Judge Hanley. Part of the reason historically that this proceeding has become what we call an ex parte proceeding, it looks different than other court proceedings where you have a notice and opportunity to be heard by both sides. But that's not correct in these emergency orders. Is that understanding correct?
That's correct. For the short term, the 20-day petition, that can be considered on an ex parte basis, that is, with only the petitioner present.
So that means if a woman feels endangered, it could be just her story that you're hearing?
Right. Okay. Right. And that's different from most of the hearings we have. We have an adversarial system where judges are accustomed to getting information and hearing arguments from two sides before making a decision. And so... For only hearing from one side or one party, you know, makes me at least a little uncomfortable, understanding that there's likely more information out there that I do not have. And so so we are cautious when we consider these applications to make sure that all the definitions are satisfied, that the testimony they give is credible, and we do our best to make sure we analyze these critically so that we don't issue a protective order when it's not warranted, because they have a big impact on people.
Talk about that.
Yeah. And if once the order is issued and then that order is served on the respondent, if it is something where the petitioner has fundamentally misrepresented something, or there's really another side to be heard, if this order goes for 20 days, is there an opportunity for the respondent to get back in front of you before 20 days is up?
Yes, there is, under the statute, an opportunity to modify or even dissolve a protective order that has been granted. So the petitioner, if no longer wants one, can come forward, or the respondent has an opportunity to come into court and say, I'd like to be heard on this, and then revisit the issue.
I would just like to remind our listeners, if they're just joining us, we're talking about legal issues, but the show is Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and my co-host is Judge Elaine Andrews, and we have Marjorie Thayer, a legal advocate from Awake, who works down at the court system. Her office is in the court, the Boney Courthouse. And we also have District Court Judge J. Patrick Hanley here in the studio with us. So we're going to continue with this, but I just, in case people are tuning in late and they're hearing ex parte order and things like that, it's about domestic violence. So.
Okay, so if a person is granted a 20-day order, is there a time to extend that order? I mean, what happens? They go in front of you. If you decide that it fits all the definitions and they're entitled to the order, what kinds of things would go into the order that would perhaps provide protection to this person? What kinds of things can you order in that short-term order?
You can order, the most important thing is that there be no contact between the people. And actually, specifically, the respondent cannot have any contact with the petitioner. That's the person that the court has jurisdiction over. And so that's the main thing. So you cannot have contact with the petitioner. You can order that they not go to the person's residence, person's place of employment, or if they go to school, where they go to school, and other places like that. Other protections that typically get or issues that get resolved in the long term, like if there's a child support, and those things are typically resolved in the long term order. But the short term order is usually designed to provide some protection by just getting separation at first.
Okay, and so a long term order then follows a short term order. Is that what happens?
So when it can. So if a petitioner fills out a short term order, there's an option on that petition to say, are you requesting a long-term order as well? And if that's the case, then one gets scheduled. And for the long-term order, that must be served upon the respondent before the court can act on it. So that one, both parties would be present, or at least the respondent was given notice that there was going to be a hearing.
I have a question about, if there's a short-term order and then the person who's what is the name of the legal person who's charged with
the respondent?
The respondent. Suppose they come in and they give you information and you decide, now I've heard the other side. I think I'm going to modify or even drop this order. Does that stay with that person's record or is it completely removed?
Well, it would certainly, we would vacate the order if that was what was going to happen. And that's a good question. On court view, it might show that it happened, but there's just been some modifications under the recent legislation from this year to remove criminal charges that are not that are dismissed. I don't know about this. I'd have to look into whether or not those would still show up on court view.
I mean, if someone kept reading the record, maybe they'd come to the fact that it was vacated. But what if they didn't? It seems a difficult spot to be in. Yeah.
Well, the court records, by and large, are public records, and so people are, they are charged with crimes that they are acquitted of. They are given traffic tickets that they're found not guilty of. So these things show on the public record, and it's in this day and age where everything there's digital access, these are all things that did not used to be so important that are now really quite important.
In front of everyone, yeah,
right.
Yeah. And I want to ask Judge Hanley, have you made mistakes on both sides, like you've said no to a protective order and later thought you should have, or said yes to a protective order and then, it's a tough spot that you're in because you're only getting, like you said, half the story.
Right. Sometimes it's clear and it's a fairly easy decision to make based on the evidence that you have in front of you. But other times it's more difficult, and it's a difficult decision, so you could second-guess yourself. And I did have one that I issued one, a protective order, and then the troopers came back to me later and said, we found the respondent, and he was actually had been in custody the entire time. So either the petitioner was confused about it was someone else, or something was going on where she gave testimony that just wasn't, in fact, the case. And so, obviously, in that case, based on the evidence that I had, I issued one which should not have been issued, so I vacated it immediately.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough spot. And you've heard these cases as well, right, Judge Andrews?
Yes.
Have you had the same experience where?
Yeah, they are they're tough cases because, as Judge Hanley said, we're used to having both sides. And we do have some extra information. The procedures are such that if a person files for a petition, on the petition itself, they're required to tell the court about other cases that they may have. So if they're in the middle of a custody dispute or a divorce or some other thing that involves the other person, they're required to tell us. And even if they don't tell us, the clerks run the name of the respondent through the court system records, and they gather those files. And so when the court hears the petition, they also have, if there's ongoing disputes between these people, the court's going to know about it, even if it's not disclosed in the petition. So sometimes we have more information than even the petitioner might realize. So that is helpful, but it is very tough to make a decision you have confidence in when you only have one side of the story.
Because you're trained to hear both sides.
You're trained to hear both sides, yes.
And that's really, yes. And have we always had that, or is that a recent development in the last years, or what do you know about ex parte in domestic violence?
When I was first doing these long ago and far away, they were not ex parte, and then they became ex parte. So it's an evolution on that.
And the driving force for ex parte is safety issues?
I think it is.
I mean, you would think. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Because the notion of even showing up in the courthouse sometimes with these two people meeting in the lobby can be explosive. I mean, we have seen it in our own courthouses, and you see these, you know, reports across the nation where, I mean, some of these situations can be very lethal. And I certainly, as a judge doing felony work, I've had, you know, the tragic situation like Glenn was talking about where, I've got a murder case going on, and part of the evidence is the DV writ that didn't work. So it's
very difficult cases.
Yeah.
We're going to take a little break, but I want to clue our audience into something we're going to have when we return from our short break. We had advertised this show on our website, and I was contacted by a local musician who has written a song about coming to grips with domestic violence. So her name is Shanti Elder. You might recognize her. She's had even music on this. She has a show on our station called Traveling Music and has been working in our community since 1978, is a music teacher. And she contacted us and wanted us to share her song. She's not free to call in and talk to us because she's a music teacher and she's teaching. But she very much wanted to share the song. So we're going to take a brief break, but come back and listen to Shanti Elder's song called My Fault. And my name is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Thank you.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Man of violence, I knew I loved him underneath, but still I couldn't stay. The hardest thing I did was leave the man I loved behind. But I knew that the cost was worth the price to pay. 'Cause it was his fault, that he always got so angry. His fault, that he chose to act that way. His fault, it was always his decision to use his fists instead of words. There was nothing I could say. To use his fists instead of words, there was nothing I could say.
Thank you, Shanti Elder, for choosing to share that song with us. And I know that our guests in the studio, our topic is domestic violence. My co-host is Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, and we also have Marjorie Thayer with us, a legal advocate from Awake, and also District Court Judge J. Patrick Hanley. I'd love to go to you, Marjorie, because the themes in that song are relevant to the topic and maybe repeat many, many times. And so could you comment a little bit for us on it?
The words are powerful, definitely very powerful, and the message that it is the victim's fault is one that is that the perpetrator definitely repeats over and over, and eventually the victim, they end up believing it, and they end up believing that it is their fault, and if only they tried harder. And that's not the case. Mm-hmm. The domestic violence is the perpetrator's choice to mm-hmm. do that.
And you've seen this over and over and over.
I have. Mm-hmm. I have worked at Awake for many years. I've been down at the courthouse for many years. The stories are very similar, and the tactics that the perpetrator uses mm-hmm. are very, very similar.
Yeah. Judge Andrews or Judge Hanley, do you want to comment at all on the song?
Well, I appreciate the willingness of someone who's known in the community to come forward and talk about it. We have about 3,000 filings a year in Anchorage alone, and so this is not a small problem, and it's not a problem that affects only one segment of society, and it is an issue in which there's a great deal of shame and secrecy around it, and so to the extent that we can kind of pull the lid off and examine it and get down to the bottom of it, I think we're all better off.
If I could add on to that a little bit, is that one of the difficult things about being a judge in these situations is that people come before and you see they're very emotional. You can tell they've been hurt, and a lot of things are going through their minds. And so you feel sympathetic toward them, but you also have to be the objective person in the room to make sure that all the statutory requirements are satisfied. So you can't let emotions kind of take charge and rule on emotions. You have to look at the facts behind them and make your best decision on those. So it can be difficult to make that separation.
You have constraints from what the legislature has allowed you to rule on, right? They
right.
set the statutes. So if there's a call for change, it goes to the legislature, not to the judge.
That's
right?
correct. Right.
So,
Right. And one way that was explained to me that I thought was very helpful to understand is that the courts work with the legal definition of domestic violence for purposes of granting these orders. But there is another definition of domestic violence that is not the legal definition. It's the behavioral health definition. That's a much broader definition. And so you can have terrible, demeaning, cruel, controlling behavior that is, in fact, domestic violence, but the court cannot issue an order to prevent it because it is not a crime of domestic violence. It doesn't fit within it. And one of the examples that a person I was talking to told me about was a woman who was terrified and kept in her home. But the way she was kept in her home is that her partner would spread powder outside the front door to make certain that she didn't leave. Now,
wouldn't see the footprint.
So she never left because he would see that she left. Now, the spreading of powder outside a front door is not an act of domestic violence. So if that person somehow told Judge Hanley about that, Judge Hanley would have to, I mean, if she was forcibly kept in the home, kidnapped, et cetera, that's an act of domestic violence. But doing these sort of cruel, controlling
behavior
is it is domestic violence. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't fit into the statute that the court needs to follow.
That's really interesting. I'm going to welcome a caller on Justice Alaska at Hometown Alaska. Hello, Linda.
Hi.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you. I'm glad you're doing the show. I think Judge Andrews just made the point that I wanted to comment on, but I want to strongly make it because, we have to understand that not all abusers are lowlifes. The person who abused me was an upstanding, quote-unquote, citizen of Anchorage and big family. If I named some names, everyone would know immediately the family. And so it was very difficult for me to leave. But once I did leave, and I went back a couple of times, and once I did leave, I went before a judge, and I got a bifurcated divorce in the interim. But then there was the issue of custody of my two little girls. And when I left to go the last time to go to the shelter, and I took my little girls with me. The judge presiding over this case reprimanded me for not leaving a note, staying where I was. And also, he stated as fact in the final decision that my abuser did abuse me. I had photos. I had quite a bit of proof. This man shoved soap into my mouth when he didn't like what I was saying by force. He threw a large cast iron wooden utensil holder, and the spoons hit my toddler at the time. He had 3 DUI convictions, but he was an upstanding person of the community, very handsome and well-dressed at all times. And he made a good impression in the court, and I lost custody of my two little girls.
This is a difficult story. Yeah.
I lost custody of my two little girls, and I was devastated. I had a good job. He made the point that because I cried in court during the testimony, and then during hearing what I cried on the stand, and the judge also stated that he didn't want to give custody of two little girls to someone who would cry on the stand. I am not kidding. This is exactly what he said.
Well, have you been able to have any other remedy, or you still don't have custody of your children today?
No. The girls left. They left. They left his house because his second wife got the same treatment.
So, what is your question?
She divorced him, and she got custody of their little boy.
Linda, what is your question? Do you feel like you didn't get justice? Is that what you think?
No, I want to say is, at the time, no, I didn't get justice. And I just wanted to make also the point that, that, you know, not all abusers are lowlifes. They don't look like lowlifes. This guy had, you know, a job, even though he did get 3 DWI convictions, the judge gave him custody, and it's all sorted out. It's not an ongoing thing right now, but I wanted to comment about. And I have another question.
Linda,
was there a time that do judges have to take in giving custody? Do judges have to take into account a person's past abuse?
Yes. Let me step in.
Please do.
This is something that has grown out of, I think, a recognition of the pervasive nature of domestic violence and how it affects children. We have a law that says in the world of custody that if a person has a DV order against them for a DV that is a serious DV, the statutory definition, I think, is serious. A DV with serious physical injury or serious threat of physical injury. I'm Marjorie, maybe you can.
It's a history of domestic violence. It's either a serious one incident of domestic violence that caused serious physical injury, or a history.
History would be two or more. Cases in which a judge has issued a domestic violence restraining order. That then creates what's called a rebuttable presumption that the respondent, the person who's accused of the domestic violence, there's a rebuttable presumption that they cannot be given sole or joint custody of the children. A rebuttable presumption means you presume they shouldn't get it. You have to persuade the judge that they should have some form of joint or sole custody. And so it can be overcome, but it has to be overcome by compelling evidence. Mm-hmm. So the law has changed in that regard, and it is in fact something that judges always had to take into account, but more so now.
Judge Hanley, anything to add to this?
Well, I think what Judge Andrews is talking about is more kind of as the case progresses, the divorce cases. What I mostly see is kind of the front end with the domestic violence and the protective orders that come in shortly after the events happen. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it common that people don't feel they got justice? I mean, it's a very emotional time. I mean, is it common that people are not happy with outcome because it's so difficult?
Well, I mean, the courts are not a happy place to be, and by definition, at least half of the people go away unhappy because someone won and someone lost, and sometimes everyone goes away unhappy.
Yeah.
So, but I think the obligation of the judge is to at least allow people to know they have been heard, and I think once people feel they've been heard, they are more likely to feel that they were treated justly, even if they didn't get what they wanted.
Yeah. Well, Linda, I'm going to thank you for calling and sharing your story. And I would like to welcome other callers on. We have Jonathan on the line. Welcome to Justice Alaska, Jonathan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call today. Appreciate your program.
Glad you're here. What's your question?
I actually kind of had a comment and wanted to answer a question you guys had on there regarding if it stays on your court view, I guess not your record, but on court view, the stalking protecting order or any type of protection order. So basically, at one point I had an ex-girlfriend who thought that I was breaking out her new boyfriend's windows or something like that. We've been broken up for a long time, and all of a sudden a trooper comes to my door and gives me a paper saying I needed to go to the courthouse. I did that, went there. The judge asked her how she knew it was me, and I didn't. It had nothing to do with it. She said she didn't know it was me. She just thought maybe because it was her new boyfriend's car. To sum it up, basically she asked her, the judge asked my ex-girlfriend if she had ever heard me threaten her or had any texts or anything like that. There was nothing like that. Basically, the story is I had nothing to do with it. I didn't even know that was happening. And so they dropped it, that it being the extended order. As you guys said, you get the 20-day order, and then after that, they have an extended order. Anyway, it has always bothered me that that's on my record and shows on there because I had, you know, no participation or even knowledge of what was happening. I am not against any of this, of course. Don't get me wrong. The protection order is great. I did, however, also end up using it myself later on in life at one point and was on the other end of it as a, not the respondent, but the petitioner. And so thank you, Judge, and everyone for your time, and that's all.
Jonathan, thank you for calling in and sharing that story. I want to give our listeners our number. I haven't put it out here for a while and generally do it more often, but we do welcome your calls at 550-8433, statewide 1-888-353-5752, and you can always email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Judge Hanley or Judge Andrews or Marjorie, any comment to Judge? He sort of had both sides. He really understands the need, was troubled by the fact that I guess a court view, you would still see some reference to a protective order against him.
Margie, did you want to clarify? We did that during the break as to what your understanding is of that.
Yeah, my understanding is if a petitioner comes in and files for a protective order and no short-term order is granted, and there is not a date set for a long-term hearing, then that information gets wiped from court view. However, if, let's say, for example, a short-term protective order is issued and at the long-term it's not granted, that short-term protective order information is still going to be in court view. A person would be able to scroll down court view and read that perhaps a long-term order was not issued, but that short-term order would still be in court view. The only time it's gone is if there's no short-term order issued and no hearing date set for a long-term.
Hmm. So if a judge denies the request, essentially, it never surfaces in the public domain.
Correct. It'll be correct.
Okay.
The information will be in court view for a short period of time because the clerks need to open the file. But as soon as if a judge does an outright denial, then that information is taken out of court view.
All right.
It's interesting. Yeah. Sticky wicket of electronic records and access.
Right, yeah. Right. And yeah. The fact that it isn't in court view doesn't mean the file doesn't exist in the courthouse, but it's now harder to, I mean, you have to go down and you'd have to know either person's name or number in order to access that file. Mm-hmm. But the court view, the digital access, is really what people are mostly concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask Marjorie about, do you go into court with when you're advocating, working as a legal advocate in the domestic violence area? Do you go into court with them? What is your role after you've got them through the paperwork and things like that?
Okay, awesome. Great question. Thank you. So we've done the paperwork. We've turned it into the clerks at the front desk. They've said, have a seat. You can be heard in front of a magistrate judge shortly. If the petitioner wants me to go into court with them, I certainly will. I do have to let them know that I'm not a lawyer. I can't give them any legal advice. I can't speak on their behalf. I can't write notes or anything like that. But what I am able to do, what my coworkers are able to do, is provide support, emotional support. A lot of times, victims of domestic violence, nobody believes them, or the abuse is minimized. And to have somebody sitting next to them, even silently, that believes what they're saying, that believes them, and can provide that emotional support, is sometimes the only support that they get. So I am able to go into court with that person. I can talk to them beforehand, before going into court, kind of give them a rundown of, you know, the judge will probably ask you to rise and raise your right hand, and you'll get sworn in. The judge may ask you what your relationship is. The judge is probably going to talk to you about, going to say, tell me what happened. What's the domestic violence? So if I can give them a little bit of information about what's going to happen and make the unknown less scary, that's a good thing. That's what I'm there to do also. And just provide support and answer questions afterwards if they have any. Maybe make copies of the protective order if it's granted. Make sure that they know how it can get served by APD or other law enforcement. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely go into court with people. And that's one of the best parts of my job, is being able to go into court with people and sit with them and be present mm-hmm. and allow them to share their story and for me to be able to be part of that.
And let me also just say, because this, we have a large state, and not things don't happen the same way in Anchorage as they happen all over the state. So in some locations, the petition is actually processed on the paperwork. In other words, you write out the petition, it gets walked into a judge's chambers, the judge looks at the paperwork, and then grants or denies the order without a hearing. And that happens actually fairly often. Anchorage is one of the places that has the resources and the hours of operation to have these hearings pretty quickly and regularly, but many of the courts outside Anchorage don't have those resources, and so the judges process the paperwork. And thinking of Len and his daughter, who was in remote parts of Kentucky, Alaska has a highly integrated system that allows small villages and small towns to communicate with judges on duty. So the notion that you would have to go to a place to get an order is not correct. We can do these over the phone, do them with the aid of troopers and law enforcement and judges on call.
And Marjorie, I had a question. Once you say you've launched, someone has launched their case, they've got a 20-day order, are you still part of that case if it goes to long-term? I mean, do they have a long-term relationship with you, or is it just that launching task that you have?
That's up to the person. If they, I will definitely offer my services, you know, like, hey, if you want to talk about what to expect at the long-term hearing, if you want to talk about how to get evidence together, perhaps talk about a timeline. If you want to do any of those things, feel free to call me, or I will ask for permission to call them. But if they want nothing, no further services, that's absolutely their choice.
Mm-hmm.
So I will do whatever they would like me to do.
And you have had this role for how long?
Gosh, I started in 2002 at working as an awake advocate at the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Judge Andrews mentioned Magistrate Judge Wells and Cole at the beginning, and it was partly due to them and a grant that they had written that got me in the courthouse, or got an advocate in the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to get the job through Awake.
Very interesting. I had no idea before we broached this topic that those services were at the courthouse. And
in addition to that, we have two dedicated police officers at that location as well, whose job is focused simply on DV. And they are the folks who help get the order served and keep the peace, so to speak. But Marjorie, you may have more information about that.
It's Officer Street, Officer Whitmore. They do domestic violence follow-up. So they get police reports. They contact victims afterwards. They are part of the, they can help get protective orders served. So yeah, they are down at the courthouse, so in the protective order office. So we're able to provide a lot of services that, you know, I think are pretty progressive and I think are needed.
Mm-hmm. And kind of tag on to that, there are also officers who are dedicated to monitoring conditions of release. So if an incident does result not only in a domestic violence protective order but a criminal case, as judges we can set conditions of release, and in domestic violence cases there's officers who go out and check to make sure that they're where they're supposed to be, or they're not having contact, or if they're consuming alcohol, things of that nature, which makes it more likely that things will be peaceful while the case progresses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. In fact, this is one, the petition is one part of other proceedings that may be going on. So the domestic violence spills over into the realm of custody and divorce, and it spills over into the realm of the criminal cases. So you can have in a single case a domestic violence petition, you can have a criminal charge, and you can also have a divorce going. And so there may be actually three different judicial officers involved with this couple or this family, although we do make a very serious attempt to get the domestic violence files over to the custody judge so that we don't have people operating, you know,
with partial information.
Yeah. Exactly.
I had one other question, and then I'm going to send it back to you, Judge Andrews. It's for Marjorie, and I was thinking about the holiday season, and I had the understanding that we saw a rise in domestic violence during holidays, and I'd just like you to tell us what your experience is and what you know about that.
And from working at the shelter and the numbers that we get from there, during the holidays, our numbers tend to go down a little bit. Families are hopeful, women are hopeful that they can be reunited. And then after the holidays, our shelter numbers do tend to go back up.
That was almost like a myth that I had come to believe that the violence spiked during the holidays, but that's not the experience that Awake has seen. It's after the holidays,
mm-hmm.
When the bills are coming in, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's stress. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
And another myth may be that it's only women who are the victims of domestic violence. I mean, by and large, numerically speaking, that is true. But we certainly have seen cases where men have been physically abused and murdered as the result of domestic violence perpetrated by women. So it's not exclusive male on female. And so
even two roommates that are not necessarily romantically involved, you could, that would qualify if say one of them.
That's right. That would be considered household members. So it could qualify for domestic violence protective order.
Right.
And I was just going to jump in and say, the name of our organization is Abused Women's Aid in Crisis, but we help men too. A lot of times guys don't think that. We help people that are victims of domestic violence. One of our, what first got me going to Awake and wanting to volunteer with Awake, which is what I started doing, was a sticker that I saw in a bathroom at UAA that says no one deserves to be hit. And it wasn't no woman deserves to be hit, it was no one deserves to be hit. And I was like, man, that's definitely a statement I can get behind. That's something I believe in. So we do. We help victims of domestic violence, male or female.
And in fact, one of the Awake victim advocates down at the courthouse is a fellow. It's a man. So one of the advocates is a man. So
and we've got male advocates working in the shelter as well.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this isn't, I have to say, an equal opportunity kind of crime that,
generally women are victimized.
Generally, the women are the victims, but it's not exclusively.
Mm-hmm. I know that I asked you, Judge Andrews, about, grandchildren and grandparents and things like that, that it's not necessarily a romantic relationship that erupts. It can be many different forms, and all of those qualify under this.
Yes. So, if there's a relationship along with the acts that we can issue a protective order against, it's always that combination of the relationship and the act. And if we have one but not the other, cannot move against it.
We talked a little bit about social media and the way people use social media, and I wondered whether Judge Hanley might see the need in the future for some addition to the criteria that you can rule on. I mean, I was surprised to hear that cruelty to animals was in there. I just hadn't thought of that, but that was that's relatively new.
That was just this legislative session, just a few months ago when that passed.
Yeah.
So that's been added to the types of crimes that could be the subject of domestic violence protective order. You still have to have the relationship. So the petitioner and the respondent and the pet, the animal has to be a pet of the petitioner.
Right.
So that could be a form of abuse. Instead of hitting the person, you hit the dog.
Wow. We could go on and on, as Judge Andrews and I are always saying. I just want to thank our guest today, Marjorie Thayer, legal advocate from Awake, and District Court Judge Patrick Hanley, and of course, my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Next week on Hometown Alaska, I'll be back as your host for our annual Salute to Community Volunteers. And Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.